Some people distinguish between complex and complicated. And if you dive deeper into the meanings of those, you can find some definitions that many people agree on. And it goes in this direction. Complicated means something is not easy, but if you take enough time to understand it, you will understand it. It's complicated. It has many complicated rules, but if you take your time, if you study, if you talk to experts, if you read the books, then sooner or later you're going to understand everything that's worthy knowing about it. For example, a diesel engine is complicated. You cannot build it easily, but you can wrap your head around it if you make the effort to do so. In contrast to that, complex is something you will never quite fully understand, because something that is complex is constantly changing and evolving. And you could say that a machine is complicated, but a human being is complex. It's an ever-evolving thing, and you will never completely understand another human being. And that's why psychology is probably more complex than technology.
Welcome to A State of Readiness, a podcast set as a fireside chat with business leaders to discuss what it takes for a company to be in a state of readiness and become a high-performance organization, with your host, Joseph Paris.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of State of Readiness. I'm your host, Joseph Paris. Today, I have a very special guest, Dr. Stefan Meyer. I met Stefan when I first arrived in Germany, probably one of the very first professionals I met upon my arrival some 10 years ago, and I immediately gravitated towards him. His conversations have always been interesting. He has different perspectives, not your run-of-the-mill conversations ever. And I'm sure that you're going to enjoy today's conversation. Professionally, Stefan has been orchestrating successful change initiatives and digital transformation for 25 years, and he's held roles such as CEO, member of the board, program manager, mentor, and coach. He's a forward-thinking advisor for avant-garde clients, the bold and the visionary, the entrepreneurs, the risk-takers, the kind of clients who are not afraid to decisively make courageous decisions and with whom he will stand on the front lines. Stefan earned his bachelor's in business psychology with a focus on organizational development at RWTH Aiken University. At a rather mature age, Stefan received his PhD in business administration at the University of Gloucestershire in England for his research on radical change by killing sacred cows in organizations. He started his professional career at Accenture, where he spent 4 years as a senior consultant in the Department for Change Management. He co-founded a private equity firm, which he has since exited, and is now the CEO for Denkstella, a consultancy, where he works directly with clients and as a hired expert for other consultancies. Welcome, Stefan. Great to have you on the podcast today. How are you doing?
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, my pleasure. It's been a long time in coming. I think that we first talked about it maybe 6 months ago or so, but finally we're together. In fact, I believe that when we first talked about it, you had not yet moved to Cyprus from Germany.
That is true. Yes.
Yeah, and my understanding is that you're enjoying the change in climate.
Exactly. Yes, it's a lot warmer here and less rainy and cold than in Germany.
Good, good, good. So you and I first met soon after I arrived here in Germany some 10 years ago or so. And I believe it was at a suboptimal attempt at a, or at least the results were suboptimal attempt of organizing a Operational Excellence Society meeting. And we ended up having it in some obscure farm-like pub out in the middle of no place. I think that you're the only one that showed up.
Yes, I very much remember that event. It really was a strange place. You probably looked it up somewhere and was as surprised as I was at the way it was well hidden in the middle of nowhere, but it was an interesting conversation we had anyway.
Yes, indeed, indeed. I've enjoyed our subsequent conversations. I've especially enjoyed speaking with you because you're outlooks and your opinions and your ideas are not mainstream. I mean, they're not, you know, completely radical either, but, you know, they're not mainstream. And, you know, sometimes I think about, you know, the emperor's new clothes, you know, the story about the emperor's new clothes where he, in fact, is naked and everybody pretends that he's not. And until somebody like you says, by the way, you're naked. And, you know, that's rather refreshing. And every time we speak, I go away thinking about the conversation well after the conversation's been had. So thank you for that.
Yeah, thanks. That's nice to hear. I actually find myself quite often in the situation of the little kid who is screaming, the emperor is naked. Yes, that's true.
Yeah. So, you know, you're a bit of a libertarian. I don't know if you're more or less a libertarian than I am, but, you know, we both have our streak, I believe. And I think that adds to, or maybe as a result of this, you know, desire to question the status quo, question everything. So, you know, tell us a little bit about how you got to be, you know, how you got to be you and some of your thoughts.
Yeah, my father was an electrical engineer, and I was his oldest son. And of course, his understanding was that I would become an electrical engineer as well. So every year for Christmas, I got one of these tiny playful gadgets for children to experiment with electronical parts. So I built radios, and I built alarm systems for houses and all these things. And after a few years, I had the impression that more or less I understood the gist of what technology is all about. Maybe not every detail, but the general idea of what technology is like. And I still like technology. I'm a very technology-minded person. I like to try out new gadgets and new software pieces. But in that situation, I thought I'm going to look for a much more complex challenge than that. What is more complex than technology? And so I finally ended up in psychology. That's what I studied after I finished my school, much to the dismay of my father. So I did not become an engineer. But after I became a psychologist, a business psychologist, I worked quite a while with several engineers, and for example, with Volkswagen and other major players in the industry. So I quite well understand how engineers think and how they work and how they communicate. So when I finished my studies in business psychology, I applied for a job at Accenture that at those time was completely unknown in Germany. No one had ever heard of that company. And since I was a psychologist, they automatically put me in the department for change management. There was no question about it. When you're a psychologist, you are change management. And that's what I've been doing ever since. That was in 96. And that's what I've been doing ever since. So for me, change management is synonymous with several other buzzwords. For example, digital transformation. For me, that's kind of the same thing as change management. And since these years, many companies were on their way of digitizing themselves or becoming more modern, modernizing themselves. And I've been accompanying several companies since in all different industries. So I've never been loyal to one single industry. And I was with Accenture for 4 years. And then I was someone hired me for building up a private equity company that was supposed to invest in high-tech startups. That was very interesting. It was a very short passage in my life, so only around about a year, but one of the most interesting, I guess. So we built up a private equity company. We set up three companies. We made all the legal stuff. I traveled all around Germany to find worthy companies to invest in. I learned quite a lot in this very short time. That was very interesting. And then came the big financial crisis of 2001, and the company folded, and the board said, we are going to discontinue this. And I was on my own, and that's when I became self-employed. That was my way into becoming my own entrepreneur or freelancer, if you so will. And my first job was a strategy project at Volkswagen. So they had a new strategy. They set up 90 projects. They completely lost the control over all these projects. And my challenge was to coordinate these kinds of projects into one portfolio that made any sense. And I've been doing similar challenges ever since. So that was quite, yeah, that was my entry into the world of being self-employed, being on my own. And then from 2001 to 2021, so 21 years, I was a freelancer in Germany until I became more and more dissatisfied with the legal status you have as a freelancer in Germany. It is like the government doesn't really want people to be self-employed. They do a lot of preventing you from doing this, either pushing you towards become an employee, or much even further than that, pushing you towards becoming a recipient of governmental funds. And they dislike people who have a certain status, who have a certain self-reliance, because they know how to earn their money by themselves. That's what they don't like in the government. And I know that because I've been involved in several political initiatives. I was an intern at the state government. I was an intern at the national government, at the Bundestag in Berlin. So I looked at all of these things closely. I talked with many politicians, with many ministers. I wanted to, as a psychologist, I wanted to understand what their mindset is. And I think I understand it, and I don't like it. And so more and more over the years, I made the decision that it would be better for me to go. And this is why I now emigrated to Cyprus. So at the end of 2021, I left Germany, and we had a very nice meeting before that. You said, oh, you're going to leave Germany, let's have a final talk. So I still remember our meeting in the steakhouse in the Taunus Mountains. It was quite,
right.
Yeah, it was quite interesting. So since
yeah,
then,
the Opal Zoo.
Yeah, exactly. And since then, that's half a year ago, I've been living in Cyprus. As you probably know, it's a divided country.
Yeah, and you're in the Greek side, right? The non-Turkish side. Yeah,
the side that that is part of the European Union. Yes, exactly.
Right. So there's a couple of questions that came to mind out of that. The first is that you made mention that psychology is more complex than engineering.
Yeah.
Why did you say that? Why do you think so?
Well, some people distinguish between complex and complicated. And if you dive deeper into the meanings of those, you can find some definitions that many people agree on. And it goes in this direction. Complicated means something is not easy, but if you take enough time to understand it, you will understand it. It's complicated. It has many complicated rules, but if you take your time, if you study, if you talk to experts, if you read the books, then sooner or later you're going to understand everything that's worthy knowing about it. For example, a diesel engine is complicated. You cannot build it easily, but you can wrap your head around it if you make the effort to do so. In contrast to that, complex is something you will never quite fully understand, because something that is complex is constantly changing and evolving. And you could say that a machine is complicated, but a human being is complex. It's an ever-evolving thing, and you will never completely understand another human being. And that's why psychology is probably more complex than technology.
I like that. That's an outstanding way of putting it. Thanks for that. That might even make the lead into the session later on. But yeah, thank you. Let's talk about Germany and entrepreneurship for a second. Also, you know, obviously, I'm an American, and I got to Germany. I had this idea about starting, a GmbH here. And I tell you what a pain in the neck it is. I had a German partner, and they wanted to read this, like 40-page document, which is in English and in German. And only the English side was governing the document. The German side was sort of like an appendix. It was there, but not really necessary. But the lawyer had to read out, or the notary, or both, had to read out loud the articles of organization. So 30 pages, they're reading the articles of organization. And it was painful because, I know how to read English. It's sort of like my first language. And my partner here in Germany was, very, very fluent in German. And he didn't think that he needed this document read to him. And then, after 30 minutes, the document has fully been read. And there's like two changes. So the lawyer goes back and makes a couple of changes, comes back after 15 minutes. And I'm like, don't tell me you have to read this whole thing again. And he's like, no, we could sign it now. And so I'm thinking to myself, we didn't sign the copy you read, but we are signing the copy you didn't read. And where did that make sense? And then we wanted to start a bank account with Commerce Bank. And they insisted that all stakeholders, all shareholders had to be present for the opening of this account. And I'm like, why? Because I'm not a signatory on the account. Why do I have to be there? All shareholders. And so I asked him, I said, do you do business with like Siemens or IBM or any of these big companies? And they're like, yeah, absolutely. I said, well, when they wanted to open up an account, did you summon all their hundreds of thousands of shareholders from around the world to your to your offices, to have them sign? And of course not. And so they waived that requirement for us too. But just like, meanwhile, I started business in Wyoming, okay? I do it online, 100% of it's done online. It cost me $50, $3 additional for the pay by credit card convenience fee. So it's $53. It's all done. I get the Internal Revenue Service. I get my tax ID online. The whole thing, start to finish, is done in like an hour. And I have the same level of limited liability corp as a GmbH would be. And I just don't understand it. So is that complex or is that complicated?
It is, most of all, it's superfluous. It just doesn't need to be that way. And we all know it and we all feel it immediately. And this probably ties back to a topic we are also going to talk about, I think, the sacred cow. Things are done because they have always been done that way, seemingly, and they don't make any sense, but you don't question them because they are just sacred cows. So that's what that's what we do around here. So,
So let's talk about the sacred cows. I mean, because when you and I met, you had your, you call it a diploma. I think it's probably the equivalent to a bachelor's degree.
Yes. A master's, I would say. Yeah.
Oh, master's. Okay. Mm-hmm. So it's a master's degree. So you have your master's degree in business psychology from a German university, and you want to go for your doctorate in business administration, but there's a sacred cow.
Yeah.
That, basically, if I recall the conversation right, meant that you were a layperson, you didn't know anything about business, even though you had run your own business for 20 years or whatever it was, and therefore you had to start over from scratch, and you didn't feel like doing that.
Yeah, the backstory is that I wanted to write a doctorate, a PhD, and friends advised two different universities to me, one of them in England, one of them in Germany. And I said, okay, before I make a decision, I talk to both of them. And when I talked to that advisor from the German university, he told me that what I was trying to do, being a psychologist and doing research in business administration, is interdisciplinary research, and that is verboten in Germany. It's illegal. And we had a phone conversation. He screamed at me over the phone, "Hi, I come up with that stupid idea of doing a dissertation in business administration when I am a business psychologist." He didn't see the connection and he didn't see the overlap and the added value of that. He just didn't understand. He just stuck stubbornly to what's in the law. It's written in the law.
And now it's the law. Let me pause you for a second. Is it just a rule, like an academic rule, or are you talking actually like a bona fide law?
Well,
like
first of all, I didn't believe him. he made it easy for me, because after that conversation, I said, thank you. I thought to myself, thank you very much. That makes it easy for me to go to England. We're going to talk about that in the English university later on as well. But first of all, I thought he was just talking BS. I didn't believe him. Later on, I talked to a German professor who confirmed me. There is a legal document called the Prüfungsordnung, and the Prüfungsordnung defines everything around this doctorate degree that is legally binding for the university. And then the Prüfungsordnung, it says you cannot do interdisciplinary research for your doctorate. However, I know one or two people who somehow managed to get it across the different, however, I don't know how they did it and why they did it. So there seem to be some ways around it, but the official setting is that you are not allowed to do interdisciplinary research in Germany. So that's why I went to England, and that made it easy for me to go to England.
So now, when you went to England, did you have the idea about doing your research on sacred cows, or did this experience with the German university instill in you the desire to kill, identify, find, and kill sacred cows?
No, I definitely had my topic, the general idea of the topic, I had it in my mind already. The thing is, I did my doctorate quite late in my life, and much later than most other people who do doctorate do it. And I, by the way, I handed in the final document after all the research on my 51st birthday. So that was quite late in life. But the advantage of doing it this late in life is, you know, exactly what you want. You made some experience, you've seen a lot of things, and I knew exactly what I wanted to do my research about. The story behind is that when I started my doctorate, I had 15 or 20 years of change management experience already. And I saw that the majority of these change management initiatives were rather boring, to be blunt. It was this big thing, someone from the management says, let's do a change management initiative. And in German, we have the saying that goes like, wasch mir den Pelz, aber mach mich nicht nass, which roughly translates as, wash my fur, but don't make me wet. And that's what the majority of the change management initiatives are about. You must change something, but please don't change anything. So it's more fake. It's more an alibi initiative than anything else. And people, they say, okay, I am in the management, or I am a member of the board, so people expect me to do some change initiatives, but I don't want anything to change. And that's why. So then these initiatives, they take several years and many people are involved. And after that, everyone is exhausted and they look back and they say, did anything change for the better? Well, not really. So the majority of change initiatives I saw were like that. They were not really bad initiatives, and you couldn't even say that they failed, but they were also not really worth the effort that people put into it. On the other hand, I saw a minority of change initiatives that I would call radical change, that were really different, where something really changed. You could say that the rules of the game changed. It was a game changer initiative. And after these radical change initiatives, things were radically better. It was radical progress by radical change, as I now call it. And I wanted to know more about it, and there wasn't much about it. The change literature was about this gradual step-by-step change, and the majority of research was about it. So I wanted to contribute to that. I wanted to contribute to us knowing more about radical change, because my belief is that we could make a better world if more people knew more about radical change. So already with that in mind, I went to the English university. What was new to me was that I thought about qualitative research. I wanted to make interviews with bearers of knowledge about radical change. And I came to that university with the idea of interviewing German interim managers. And my professor was fine with that. Of course, we had a lot of discussion about methodology and ontology and whatever. That's very, especially in England, they put lots of efforts about the philosophical background and with what kind of mindset. That's very important in England, probably much more than in Germany. So we had all this discussion, but What I was supposed to do was making interviews with bearers of knowledge about radical change. So I already made some interviews with German interim managers, and then both of us, we had lunch, and you said, you suggested that I also do some interviews with interim managers from the States. And I thought that was a good idea, and I talked to my professor and he agreed. So I did that. And after these interviews, my professor said we should add some different perspectives. I was supposed to also talk to some consultants and line managers who had experience with radical change. And since I was already on my way of doing an international thing, now I went really international. I talked to experts from Canada over South Africa to Hong Kong. So I had already four continents covered, and I was just about to arrange my last interview, thinking about why not take someone from Australia, then I will have five continents together. I already picked someone, and then my professor intervened and said, I have a better idea. I should talk to someone from the world of government, because I only talked to the world of private enterprise. So I talked to at least one from person from the government. And I said, well, that's an interesting idea, but as you know, the government is not exactly known for being knowledgeable about radical change. And at that moment, it was very practical that I studied at this English university, because the city the university was at is the same city as is the headquarter of the British Secret Service. So I talked to one of those guys, and he was very talkative about change. What does the Secret Service do? Of course, radical change, so it fit quite well. And in our little discussion, in our little research group, we called this interview the James Bond interview. So even James Bond contributed to my kind of research.
Hey, that's pretty fascinating. What did you find as a result of your research?
I had a set of questions, and there was a fixed set of questions, but I also somehow intervened with some impromptu questions if the situation demanded it. For example, I wanted to find out what defines radical change, what makes it different from the other kind of change. And some people said it has an entrepreneurial character, meaning you create something new, you create something that hasn't been there before. And some people said, if you want to make a radical change, what you need is to change your perspective. Some people distinguish between working in your company as opposed to working on your company from the outside. So if you want to do a radical change, you have to move from the inside to the outside, look at your company from the outside, from a meta perspective. And from that perspective, you are much it's much easier for you to make a radical change, to really change the rules of the game, so to speak. Also, among all these questions, there was one question that was my favorite question, because I think if the answer to that is yes, it's going to change everything. And that question was, does every organization need a radical change every now and then? And the answers to that was science as science is, because half of my respondents said yes and the other half said no. That science would have been much more practical if everyone agreed on it 100%, but that's not what science is like. So one half of my respondents said yes. They said every organization needs a radical change. They mostly referred to mid-sized companies, so family business, for example. And they said, if you want to stay in the market on a long-term basis, and family businesses think on a very long-term perspective, like from giving the company from generation to generation, so they probably have the most long-term perspective of them all. So if you think from a long-term perspective, you have to perform a radical change every few years, and preferably before any crisis hits you. And if you do that, you have a good foundation for being there on a long-term basis by implementing a radical change every now and then. That's what one half of the respondents said. And the other half said, no, radical change is per se a good thing, but you only need it under certain prerequisites. And of course, and I asked, what are these? And they gave me three. So one of them is a change in law. When your business model becomes illegal, that's always a good reason, especially in Germany, where people are very law-abiding. And the second reason is a change in technology, which basically runs under the label of digital transformation. So you could say that there is no industry that's not affected by that at the moment. And in general, the experience is about change in technology that your competitors are already more advanced than your company is. And you look somehow old fashioned in the eye of your clients. And the client says, you know, how are you doing this? And the other ones are doing it in a more modern way. Should I change my supplier, my provider? And that's when you get under the pressure of also switching to a more modern approach of doing things. So that's reason number two. First of all, law. Second of all, technology. And reason number three are events of higher power. Everything from 9/11 to pandemic. That could also be a very good reason for radical change. And if any one of these three apply, and you could say that's enough reason of thinking about radical change. If you belong to this one group, the other group says radical change in any way, do it on a regular basis.
Okay, so let's talk about those two things, because you know, I find them fascinating. In my book, I actually refer to them as disruptors. So the second set, where people endure or initiate radical change because of a external credible disruptor. Okay. When I say credible disruptor, what's the difference between a credible disruptor and a non-credible disruptor? A credible disruptor has truly destructive power. It doesn't mean that they have to use it, but they possess it. So the law is truly destructive power. I mean, you can't ignore it. I mean, it's just something you have to do. You might change your circumstances, but that is going to be a radical change. You know, competition, technology, you know, all of these things are outside of, you know, the four walls of your organization, but they are a credible threat to your organization, and you must invoke some level of radical change in order to, introduce those countermeasures to make you thrive or survive. The other is about the internal radical change. Is there a circumstance that exists where a person that works as in an organization as a leader, you know, the CEO of a company, without one of these external influencers, these disruptors being introduced, have you ever seen or heard of a CEO just waking up one day and saying, I have to do a radical change in my organization?
Let me talk about this in a metaphorical way. So, okay. I like to tell the story because every now and then I encounter people who attentively listen to what I have to say, and they say, well, change is a very good thing. And we all agree that change is necessary because things change and times change, but we don't need this radical change stuff. We need incremental change because we want to have everyone on board, and it takes time. And when we change, we go step by step. And that's probably what many people, if not the majority of experts, think about change. And I would disagree with it. Yes. So there are people who doubt the necessity of radical change, and they say we need change. We agree on that. But we want to take everyone on board, and it takes time. And this is why we only apply this incremental kind of change. We don't need radical change. And then I say, oh, really? So imagine for a minute that you are the new premier or the new prime minister of Great Britain. You want to modernize the country, and part of your modernizing initiative is to switch on the traffic, or the road traffic, to the right side of the road, as most civilized countries in the world do. So you say, okay, this is part of my initiative. I have to do it to be trustworthy, and so people believe that I'm really willing to change things and make progress. But then you have doubts, and the doubts tell you, well, people told me we have to bring everyone on board and you have to do it step by step. So you make the following plan. On the first day, only the trucks drive on the right side of the road. Second day, also the buses. Third day, everyone drives on the right side of the road. So everyone who hears this can clearly see this is never going to work. And what I want to say with the story is there are situations where radical change is the most reasonable thing to do. I do not claim that radical change is the solution to everything, but I do claim that there are situations where radical change is better than anything else, if not even the only possible option. So this is why I think it is so important to do that. And in that case, the prime minister is actually giving the reason for radical change, because he says, now we're going to switch to driving on the right side of the road. So he's the instigator of this radical change.
Right. But my point was that, first off, it's a new prime minister. Mm-hmm. Okay. And the prime minister has the power.
Yeah.
All right. Maybe there's the traffic cop. All right. And the traffic cop has been there forever. And all of a sudden he says, we're going to all switch sides. Nothing's going to happen because he's got no power. Okay. And a prime minister that had been in there for a long time wouldn't think to change sides, because it just, when I think about radical change, it's almost always, and I can't think of an exception to this, by the way, either that I've experienced or that I've read about or that I've, you know, otherwise heard of, where radical change occurred organically from within the existing structure of an organization. It always comes from some external influencer with power, new CEO, new COO, a merger of companies, and a divestiture of companies, a global economic meltdown like we had in 2007, supply chain, COVID, something powerful and new is the catalyst for that radical change. At least that's what I believe. But I also believe that, as you say, it's necessary. Maybe not every day, because people get change fatigue, but meaningfully, and as a result of a necessary change in strategy or even tactics.
Yes, I agree with you on that. I talked to many interim managers, and one of the questions was, who's going to make the decision whether a radical change is necessary? And all the interim manager agreed on one thing. They said, I don't have to make the decision. If people hire me, they want to do radical change. Otherwise, they wouldn't have hired me. So the interim manager is completely free of making that decision. If he is on board, he knows that he's being paid for making radical change.
Right, right. You know, I'm involved in a project now. I've been involved in two turnaround projects. One was a true turnaround project. That was last year in Florida. This company was broken, and I don't want to get into it because it was just too broken. And I got in way too late. The company I'm working at now is in a completely different space. They're making money in spite of themselves, but they could do much more. And they recognize that, and they're going through a bunch of changes. And they brought me on board to, for lack of a better term, try to organize, prioritize, and march these changes down the line. And, you know, a lot of people talk about change, but there's a lot of difference between talking, planning, and doing, right? You know, it's like hitting the launch button and making that progress occur is a lot different than just talking about it.
Mm-hmm. And one thing I would also like to clarify, the thing with the sacred cow, it's common metaphor in German language, I think also in English language.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
My definition of sacred cow is it's a behavior that may have been useful in the past, but is not useful anymore. This could also imply that it has never been useful at all. But the most important aspect is now, at the present, it's not useful. So this is why you have to get rid of sacred cows. And when I say that, some people intentfully misunderstand me and say, getting rid of sacred cows means firing people. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying getting rid of outdated behaviors, outdated methods, outdated mindsets.
Yeah. Right. But sacred also implies that it's beyond challenge.
Yes, you are not allowed to question it, because the old master always did it that way. And if you ask, why are you doing it that way? They say, well, that's what we do around here. We've always been doing it. And where would we be if we didn't do it? And that's why it's sacred. You know, you're not allowed to question it by authority.
There's a good book out there. It's probably a decade plus old, maybe 15 years old, entitled Sacred Cows Make the Best Hamburgers. Yeah. And it talks about this very thing. And it's a wonderful enjoyable book, because it's not serious. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. So it's not, you know, it's tongue in cheek, and it gives a lot of great anecdotes, but there's a lot of lessons in between the smiles. So, yeah, excellent. So, your sacred cows, you know, or not your personal sacred cows, but how do you identify a sacred cow? And then once you identify it, what do you do about it?
Yes, that's a good question. It's an understanding that goes along with that is that usually people like to stick to their sacred cows because it's easier. And if you, I mean, you could apply the metaphor of the sacred cow in any area of your life, even in private life. And people say, if you want to develop, you must get out of your comfort zone. I mean, what more can you do to get out of your comfort zone than to leave your country and move to a different country, right?
So you I'm with you there. I completely agree.
Yeah, you also have gathered some experience in that area. Yes, and but if we, for a moment, if we just apply it to the world of business, one thing of sticking to sacred cows is that there is a product and every product has a life cycle. And for some time, it's quite useful if you need a new kind of product, you take an iteration of the old product. So you don't completely abandon it. You take the product and make some refurbishing, and then you have a quasi new product. And that's easy, and that's quick, and that's cheap. And I understand the rationale behind it, why people do it. But my statement is, you cannot do this endlessly. And too many people try to do it endlessly, to take something old and refurbish it and refurbish it and refurbish it until it doesn't make any sense anymore. If you do it for too long, if you don't get rid of your sacred cow in time, it's dangerous. It may even cost lives. And to give you an example for that, there is this company Boeing, which is one of the two major airplane builder, the other one Airbus in Europe. And the funny thing is Boeing even was a German engineer who founded this. So it's mostly both of these companies are somehow heavily influenced by Jones. Anyway, so there's these two companies always in rivalry. And Boeing had an old cash cow, the Boeing 737, and that was quite successful. The first one, I believe, was made in the 1960s. And for many decades, when Boeing needed a new plane, they just took the old 737 and made some tweak about it, and then they had a new product. And the engineers at Boeing already had the opinion, okay, this probably after 40 years has reached the end of their life cycle. We could just put it peacefully to rest and start with something new. And then once again, Airbus came up with a new product, and the management at Boeing said, we have to react to that. So for another time, let's take this old 737 and make a new tweak on it to have a new product to offer to the market. And the engineers rolled their eyes already. They said, oh, again and again. But well, that's what the management said. So that's what they did. The thing is that the Boeing 737 was built in a way that was appropriate in the 60s. It was small and it was quite low, and there was limited room for the engines. But the engines got bigger over the year, and already the past iteration of the 737, the engineers had to do a specific tweak in order to get that engine in there because the space was limited. So they made the engine X-shaped to even fit it in there. But now, with the very new last iteration of the 737 called the 737 Max, the engine was so big it didn't even fit in there. So they had to put it further in front of the airplane, and that caused some balancing problems. And if the airplane was in danger of going too high or going too low, and then they implemented a very complicated electronic solution, and that was faulty. But they still put the plane to the market, and two airlines who bought these planes had crashes, and over 300 people died. And why did they die? Because Boeing stuck too long to the old sacred cow. They couldn't get over the old cash cow. They couldn't get over the sacred cow. They couldn't say, okay, this time this plane has reached the end of the life cycle. We're going to put it to rest. It served beautifully. It made us a lot of money. But now is the time for a new plane. And of course, developing a new plane, it takes a little more time than tweaking, and it takes a little more money. But you have to do it. You cannot prolong an old cow endlessly. It's going to hurt you, and it may even cost lives.
You know, it's It's a great analogy. I know a little bit, some additional, just because of my relationships there at Boeing and in aviation in general. But, the debate internally to Boeing was, do we create a new aircraft specifically designed around the new technology and capabilities, or do we just try to extend the life cycle of the previous model, as you're sharing? But it really came down to time and money, which is what it always comes down to, right?
Of course.
A new aircraft, if it was going to be a completely new model, would have a much longer development and certification cycle than putting a max on an existing number, if you will, model number. So that extended the time. And of course, now you have to extend the additional development costs. And the Airbus already had, which its base design being younger allowed it, the 320 Neo, was able to take those more efficient engines because the base design of the 320 was younger than the 737. And it already had, a little bit more, a bit of an edge, if you will.
Yeah, I get your point, and I understand the rationale why people stick to the old thing, because it's cheaper and it's faster. Of course, it makes sense. What I say is you cannot do it endlessly. You have to finally put the old cow to rest and get a new one.
Yeah, yeah. But sometimes 300 people have to die in order to figure that out, right?
Unfortunately, yes.
Yeah, unfortunately. So you have this this whole theory, the hypotheses around sacred cow, and what are some of the things I was looking at? You have this thing called the cow canvas, mm-hmm. right? And with a K and a K. So mm-hmm. Explain a little bit about what the cow canvas is.
Yeah, the cow canvas is a test you can perform if you want to find out, is it time for me or is it time for my organization to conduct a radical change? And it's a sequence of six questions. And if you go through these, you can find more clarity about it. Do you want me to go a little deeper into it?
Yeah, please, please. Don't keep the audience in suspense.
Yeah, I think I'm going to make sooner or later, I'm going to make something like a downloadable version to that on my website. I haven't done it yet, but probably I think I'm going to do it so people can get access to it. So it's a sequence of six questions. And the first question is, what does your customer get? And if we do it, for example, let's take an example. I grew up my childhood in the 70s and 80s, and in those times when you wanted to listen to music, to your favorite music, you couldn't use television because music television wasn't invented and the radio played awful stuff, so you would go to the record store. And with that record under your arm, you would go to the living room because that's where the record player was at. So if we take, in those times in Germany, there was a brand that was called the Mercedes of record players. It was the company Dual. Was the prestige record player. And that company was incredibly successful and they completely disappeared. They went bankrupt. There's still some brand, but I think they sold the brand rights to some other companies. But they were so successful, why did they disappear? And the cow canvas can, as an example, bring some clarity about it. So if we take, for example, the question number one, what do the customers get when they buy something from the company Dual? They get a record player. Okay, that's quite easy to understand. So what is the sacred cow about it? Is that when you would have asked the employees of Dual, what are you doing? They would say, well, we build record players. That's what we do around here. So it's the sacred cow is about your self-understanding. Who are you? What do you do? And they say, we build record players. That's what we do. And the question number three is, but what's the taboo about this? And the taboo is that do people really need record players? Actually, no. In those days, they needed a record player to play the music, but they would only need the record player as long as it's the most feasible thing to play the music. As soon as some other way would come, some way that would be faster or cheaper or quicker or more technologically advanced or more user-friendly or more fashionable or whatever, then the record player would be out of fashion. And that was a taboo, and people knew that this was a relevant topic, but they didn't talk about it. And that is question number three. And question number four is, what is the essence behind it? So what are we really talking about here? And when you ask people, or when you would have asked people, why do you listen to music? Well, of course, listening to music is nice, and that's why many people do it. But I would say, as a psychologist, people listen to music because it makes them feel better. And if you're somehow in the dumps or whatever, you listen to some of your favorite music and you feel better, and that's how it works. So that leads us to question number five. Number five is opposite of the question, what is the sacred cow? Who are you? People say, we are in the record player business. We build record players. The radical change of the sacred cow would be a redefinition of who you are. So we are not in the record player business. We are in the business of making people feel better by providing them with music. If the company Dual would have had that understanding of what they do in those days, they could now be the leading provider of music, maybe an internet portal, maybe an online shop or streaming service, whatever. It's just a sign of the times in whatever way it comes along. But they only defined themselves as providers of record players. If they would have defined themselves, according to this question, as provider of feeling good by delivering music, or as music provider, they could still be a leading figure in the market. And now the last final question, question number six, in opposition to what do your customers get, a record player is the last question, what should your customers get? They should get access to music in order to make them feel better. And I would presume if they would have thought that way, if they would have gotten rid of their sacred cows, they could still be a leading brand in the international market, and people would preferably buy their music at the company Dual.
Yeah, but wouldn't you say sometimes that these industry transformations come from outsiders? You know, like I wrote one of the chapters in my book is entitled The Stone Age Didn't End Because They Ran Out of Stones. All right?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And the idea is that, you know, outsiders to an industry are more likely to transform an industry than insiders. I mean, we saw it with Apple and the iPhone. Okay, you know, they came out with the iPod months or years before the iPhone, and BlackBerry dominated the smartphone industry at the time. And so, if BlackBerry had just looked at the iPod and said, "You know what? It's already got Wi-Fi capabilities. If I added phone capabilities to it, I could have an industry killer." But they didn't want to give up their tactile.
I completely agree with you that this impulse comes from the outside. That is the strange thing. So there are people with different mindsets in new young companies, and they are somehow able to grasp the sign of the times or what the audience demands. And they grasp it in the better way than the bigger, larger players. And right. The astonishing thing is even the major companies who claim to be quite well-equipped at innovation, they very often fail at doing this. And what they do in order to stay relevant is not developing these new products themselves, but to scan the market, what is an interesting startup, and then buying that startup and integrating it into the company. Because they say they from themselves, from their own resources, are completely incapable of being up to date with that, and then they just buy the ones who are.
Exactly. So, I mean, we could see it in Kodak and inventing digital photography and you know, basically making them bankrupt because they couldn't uninvent it once something's invented, right? You know, Elon Musk, of course, with both the electric vehicle. I mean, he wasn't from the automotive industry before he started Tesla, and he wasn't in the aerospace industry before he started SpaceX. So I think, yeah, that, you know, more often than what's that? Sorry.
People are so caught up in their ideologies or in their belief system. So I have an internal information because my father worked all his working years at the same company, Philips, which is the European equivalent to General Electric, more or less. So it's a company that they have very inventive engineers, and they do lots of household supply and high fidelity supply and all of these different things. So they were the forerunners in the invention of the compact disc at the time when everything was still analogous and people listened to vinyl records, etc. So they very much pushed this forward. And they had one major problem. They wanted to make something that is a successor of the vinyl record, but on a digital basis. So they developed this compact disc, and they had prototypes, and everything was working well. It was fantastic quality compared to what you had with your old record player. And it was so advanced and was great, but they had one problem. They said, we cannot sell this product because their prototype was, it looked like a vinyl record. It was as big, but it was shiny and silvery. And they said, this is so big. It has more than 3 hours of playtime. Which band, when they make a new record, when they make a new album, has more than 3 hours playtime? In order to sell it, we would have to put different music on it, like a rock group, and then some jazz, and then some classical music, and all on the same record. And who's going to buy this freaking record? Nobody will. And then somebody came along and said, you could make it smaller. And he said, ah! That's people are so attached to their belief systems. And that's why many inventions just take a lot longer than they should.
Yeah, that's great. Well, listen, Stefan, it's been great having you as a guest on my podcast. I really appreciate it a great deal and for sharing your insights and your journey. Have any parting thoughts for my audience? Guidance, advice?
My suggestion is take a look at your sacred cows and get rid of them on time.
There's a saying that I often use, either the people will change or the people will change.
Exactly.
Yes. So, yeah. All right. Thanks again. Have a great day, and we'll speak soon.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye. Bye.
Thank you for listening to State of Readiness. You can discover more episodes and learn about the book written by Joseph Paris of the same title at www.state-of-readiness.com. You can learn more about Joseph Paris at www.josephparis.me/card.